Probably not. Need one? That's that amendment if you want to take a look at it.
I just want to let you know that you have legislative this morning, okay?
Well, that's what Tom wanted.
Is Shannon bringing my NASPER folder?
Is she bringing what?
The NASPER bill folder.
Yes.
That's what Tom wanted. He wanted an amendment to 461. Oh.
I thought you put it in
my folder.
Oh, okay.
Adam.
Also, the fact that you didn't get here until 8:15 doesn't mean anything.
Here's an oldie but goodie.
Oh, yeah.
John, can you run my
Brooklyn.
Hi, Senator. Did she put my email?
All the folders for her bills for today?
Early, early business. A 10 o'clock appointment for her.
No.
Oh, no. Senator, she has a 10 o'clock appointment for a root canal.
I have had this terrible toothache for the last week, and I have a 10 o'clock appointment.
So we'll try to get you in before then.
Yeah, please.
What time do you need to leave?
Well, it's in St. Paul. I made it in St. Paul because I wanted to be close to work. But I suppose by about 9:30 I should leave. And I think...
Well,
The Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. We'll start with Senate File 714.
We'll begin this morning with Senate File 714, Controlled Substance Electronic Reporting Program. Senator Berglund.
I'm sure I'd like to begin by making you aware of the A11 amendment. When we get a quorum, I'd like to adopt that amendment. It would make sure that any prescription that's issued by a hospital would be part of the record. Would not include, you know, short-term samples, but would include regular prescriptions. This bill, Madam Chair and members of the committee, is a bill that would allow Minnesota to apply for funding for an electronic reporting system to track controlled substances. And we are... one of a few states that has not yet applied for federal funding that's available to start this kind of a system. This legislation would allow for the tracking of Schedule II and Schedule III narcotic drugs. And the reason that this would be in effect would be a helpful tool if we're able to apply for the money, federal funds, is the fact that we have quite a bit of evidence that for some people, there's a lot of doctor shopping that goes on to try and get many more prescriptions than would be needed for any medical purpose. The bill is here in part because we know that there's planning money and there's startup money, but there may in the future at some time be a need for ongoing operating funds. And so the fiscal note at this time doesn't show any general fund request, but we need to be aware that that may happen in the future. I'd like to have Dr. Kahn and Jim Anway come forward to give their testimony at this time.
Okay. Dr. Kahn, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reason why we're recommending this bill, NASPAR, is that we realize in the medical community there's a huge problem with with diversion of prescription drugs. Federal studies show that the rate of diversion, even in Minnesota, is about 4% of prescription drugs. And because of that, and 30 states have already adopted prescription monitoring programs, and where states have placed in prescription monitoring programs, the rate of diversion drops approximately by 90%, that we feel that it would be beneficial in Minnesota also to be having this program. It would allow patients who need the medications to get their medications and those who are diverting to be identified much more readily. There is money available through the Justice Department in the budget for this year. There's over $9 million, and it's also proposed in the presidential budget. So there is money available for a program. We're hoping to be able to start up our program in Minnesota based on this.
Thank you. Senator Berglund has the A11 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A11 amendment is adopted. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members, then just in closing, we do know that during 2005 and 2006, of the people that are on our medical assistance restricted program because of suspected problems with drugs, 65 died from drug overdoses during that two-year period, and that was 14% of the deaths in that program. So I believe that this will be a great tool for physicians to properly treat their patients. I believe it also will save lives and hopefully help many people get into appropriate drug treatment programs.
And Senator Berglund, it's my understanding that you have been able to work with a number of stakeholders that would be involved in this, hospitals and pharmacies and medical board,
yes,
putting this together. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Berglund, do you have a motion?
I would move that Senate File 714 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
On Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Berglund. Senator Berglund, do you want to move on to Senate File 461?
Yes, I would.
Senate File 461 is the food stamp benefit modifications. Senator Berglund.
This is the vehicle for our one-time funding bill. And we do have a tracking sheet that looks like this for the bill. And included in the bill is $40 million for county case management on a one-time basis. $8 million for county child support, lots of federal funding on a one-time basis, $135,000 for the food stamp bill that we heard earlier, $5,000 for nursing facility rate increase for sprinkler systems, that would be a one-time rate increase, $400,000 for grave markers for Remembering with Dignity Project. And then there'd be $2.465 for revolving loan fund for e-health records in the Department of Health. there would be $10 million for pandemic influenza preparedness. This is the Department of Health's request for the antivirals and the respirators and equipment. That would be a one-time funding request. And then $1 million for a revolving loan fund for window lead abatement.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, then I would move the delete everything amendment. Contains the operating language for these items. It's an A5
amendment. Yes, we have it.
Oh, I almost forgot one. Important one.
Before we move on the A5 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The A5 amendment is adopted.
And I almost forgot that the $8 million for repairs and betterments at the Veterans Home. That is the entirety of our recommendation to the full Finance Committee for the use of one-time money. Does not mean that there might not be some one-time money in the omnibus bill also, but this would be meeting our soft target for the one-time money that's available within the Finance Committee. There may be one-time money that we find and make available within our own bill as well.
Questions from the committee? This is the first time that we're seeing this, so
yeah, this is a little fast.
Senator Berglund, maybe
we have actually heard all these bills as separate bills.
It's maybe you would like to just comment on the county case management. I think that I'm really pleased to see that component is that there's funding. Being provided for that. My sense is that it's because of the uncertainty of the federal funding, where the federal funding is ultimately going to shake out
Right. We haven't actually gotten the rules that the federal government's promulgating regarding case management. As the department indicated, we don't know for sure exactly how large our reduction will be. This will give the county some bridge money and give us an opportunity to look at it further next year. In regard to the child support funding, I'm hoping over the interim the department can work with members of this committee to try to establish some kind of a fee that would be placed on the obligor's child support amount so that one-time funding will be bridge funding also until we can replace it with permanent fee revenue.
I'm just going to stop you for a moment. Senator Prentner-Solon.
Sorry, Madam Chair. I can wait for Senator Berglund to go through the provisions. I have a question in general.
Okay. Senator Berglund.
The food stamp is a one-time, primarily systems change money, and it does have savings in the tails. We will be taking those savings in our omnibus bill. The nursing facility rate increase, we heard that bill. It was Senator Erickson Rope's bill, and it would be great assistance to our nursing homes if they do not have to borrow money to meet this federal mandate. We heard the bill, the Remembering with Dignity bill, that was a Senator Lori bill, and is a one-time request. I don't believe that the eHealth revolving loan fund will be enough, but it will help to fund that partly out of one-time money. The governor's request is quite large. The pandemic flu is a request that was in the governor's budget. That was a Senator Fischbach bill, and primarily antivirals, but there is some money in there for respirators and for one-time equipment in case of a pandemic influenza outbreak. the revolving loan fund for window lead abatement. The request was larger than this, but this would be an interest-free revolving loan fund to replace lead paint windows in older homes where children live. And lead paint on windows is one of the primary ways that children are exposed to lead in their blood. This would be a revolving loan fund that would be administered at the local level, and we can feel good about the fact that it would continue then to serve families long into the future. And then we heard about the Veterans Homes Board request for repairs and betterments funding, and this was also in the governor's bill, and that was carried by Senator Fischbach.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. Senator Prentner-Solon?
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, I didn't hear your prefacing comments, and I was wondering, is this all the one-time money that's assigned to this committee?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Prentner-Solon, yes, this was our soft target, and this is a recommendation to the Finance Committee, which means, I guess, that it could change, but I'll fight very hard for these items.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Berglund.
If there are no other questions, then I would move that Senate File 461 as amended be recommended to pass.
On Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the division.
Senator Tomasoni, welcome to our committee. We'll take your bill.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, before I get started, there's a delete everything amendment. If somebody could move that amendment, then we can put the bill in the shape that I would like to.
Senator Prentner-Solon moves the delete everything amendment for Senator Tomasoni. Is there any discussion, any questions? I think he's making his bill much less costly. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Senate File 1585 is an attempt by dentists, especially from my area, to bring dental care to an underserved population of children who are mostly on Medicaid. And the reason for the bill is because the reimbursement rates are so low for dentists that oftentimes these kids can't get any dental care. And I personally have participated in some free dental clinics where the dentists just offer their service for a day and treat these kids and let them come in for free. And it's actually, without me being having any knowledge whatsoever of dentistry, it was pretty ugly what I saw in some of those kids' mouths. And so we need to figure out a way to make sure that we get to this underserved population. And what this is an attempt to start a couple of pilot programs in a couple of counties and see how it works and see if we can get the dentist to take some of these kids by increasing the reimbursement rates in this population. And I'll have Dominic Sposetto here run through the amendment, but I think it's critically important that we figure out some way to start treating these young children who aren't getting dental care right now. Dominic.
Madam Chairman, I'm Dominic Sposetto. I'm here representing the Minnesota Dental Association. Before I begin with the discussion of this bill, I want to thank Senator Berglund and this committee for helping us with the critical access dental provider legislation over the last couple of years. And in fact, your action saved that program last year. And I'm pleased to report that we've doubled the number of dentists and clinics participating. We have over 200 dental clinics and providers involved in that program, and they are, in essence, creating a safety net for public program recipients. This particular bill attempts to put some money into a grant program that was established several years ago. There's no longer funding for it, but we would like to refund it to look at three different kinds of projects. All of the projects are building on something we call the Oral Health Solutions Project, which is a collaborative effort with a large group of dental stakeholders in the Department of Human Services to try and look at an alternative delivery system or a new delivery system for dental care that addresses some of the problems that are inherent in the current system. And the key feature of this is that we are working with the department. We have been working for the last 3 years. We are in the process, hopefully, of getting a federal waiver to allow us to set up this alternative delivery system. But in the meantime, we think it's important to begin to build the infrastructure that we would need to work with this system. Primarily involved in this is items contained in the Oral Health Innovations Grant, particularly a single contact point for patients and providers through an 800 number that would give us the ability to identify not only community clinics, Head Start clinics, school programs, the University of Minnesota Dental School, and individual providers that are working within the system so that we can set up appropriate targeted referrals to people and hopefully also involve deterring people from emergency rooms. I think that's a very important first step. We also want to utilize collaborative practice hygienists to go into school settings, Head Start clinics, and other areas where they can identify, actually triage, and identify those children that are likely to have the most dental problems and hopefully get them in for early intervention. We also want to open this up to all dental providers. The current system we have now is based on a PMAP system that works through basically medical plans, which are not really designed to provide dental care. And as a result, many dentists aren't participating. If we create our own dental network, worked with dentists and those that understand the dental practice, I think we'd be able to attract more dentists to serve in this particular program. And with the referral system that we have set up, we could make sure that it's spread out throughout the community. We also want to open up an opportunity for the dentist in Senator Tomasoni's district to create a pilot program that they're working on to provide dental care for children. This is something that they've been very excited about doing, and we think through a grant we could begin to set up that type of a program. We're also interested in working with dentists in Beltrami County who are interested in setting up a nonprofit clinic there, which ultimately, once it's set up, I'm sure would qualify as a critical access dental provider and get the increased reimbursement that goes with that. So, Madam Chairman, we're trying to do a lot with a little bit of money. We appreciate your consideration of this, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Members, I believe the reason this can be a one-time appropriation is because they're trying to get this started prior to getting a federal waiver approval. And that federal waiver has been pending since last biennium. And they think it'll come through before the end of this biennium, but with this money, they'd be able to start prior to that time. Any questions? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni. First, we appreciate your forethought in trying to bring us something that we might be in a better position to be able to support. So thank you for that. Will counties, do counties apply to be a part of this pilot? I see that there's an opportunity for an additional underserved area of the state. So does a county apply for that, or does the department pick them, or how is that?
Madam Chairman, Senator Lynch, actually it's individual entities, not necessarily the counties that provide that would apply for the grant. It would be either a group of dentists, a clinic, an entity that wants to put together this type of project. It could be the county working cooperatively with a group of dentists. But it's fairly open on who would apply, and it's up to the Department of Human Services to award the grant.
Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Tomasoni, and Mr. Spizzetto. And I'd like you to thank you, all three of you, for working together with me to try to help bring some needed funding to the Beltrami County area. If any of the other members are interested, I have a information sheet here about the Dental Health Center that fundraising has been going on to try to get this off the ground for quite some time. I think about $200,000 in private funds have already been raised, but it's still this should be maybe something that will allow that to get started. We have over nearly 5,000 people in our community going outside of the area every year at the present time because of not having the access to a doctor or a dentist who will accept their dental coverage. And often they're traveling as much as 2.5 hours to the closest dentist where they can get an appointment. So I know how much this is needed in our area, and I really appreciate your efforts.
We have two other people that notified us that they want to testify on the bill. I'd like to call those people up now. Oh, different bill number. Okay. No other people on this one. Good. Any further questions? Seeing none, Senator Olson will move that Senate File 1585 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm going to ask Senator Roebling to come up next because she has a dental appointment this morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I felt like I should come and testify on that last bill because I know what it's like to have a bad toothache and not be able to get in as quickly as you would like to get service. And I also know that I believe the state dental plan that we are on is the same one that a lot of people on medical assistance are on, and it's hard to find providers. And so I understand Senator Tomasoni's dilemma with getting service to areas, especially in rural areas. So thank you for moving me up. So I don't usually look forward to a root canal, but today I'm looking forward to it. I come to you with Senate File 536, and it was originally brought to me by the members of the Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association. And several years ago when we had our budget shortfalls, we told the counties that they could start charging for the licensing and the background checks for the family child cares. And we kind of put caps on that they could charge up to $150 a year for the licenses and up to $100 a year for background studies, but it wasn't to exceed the cost of the background studies. But as we might have guessed, with 87 different counties, we ended up with a lot of different rates. And I actually do have a handout for members showing what the different counties have charged over the last couple of years. Only one county chose to charge $150 every year, and a number of them have not charged, some of them haven't charged anything, some of them have charged $30, $50, there's quite a few at the $50 range. And what we're coming with today is to ask that we set that licensing cap at $50 a year. The ones who are charging less than that, of course, could continue to charge less. But we're looking for some equity across the state for our providers. We're also looking for a way to encourage more people to become licensed providers. And sometimes we're concerned that the startup costs, the initial licensing fees are high and scare people out, so to speak, so that instead of moving into a licensed program, they stay unlicensed, and we simply feel it's better, and we have a little more oversight when they're in a licensed program. And so that's what the first section of the bill does, is it just simply says that the annual license fee would be $50 a year, $100 for a two-year license. We do have another handout that shows, let's see, and who has that? It's been passed out. That, and I think you may have it. It's the Kids First handout. It shows what the counties would, there's only some counties that will be affected by this, of course, by reducing the fee. And if you look at the license difference, it's third to the end column, you'll see what the different counties would would be picking up the difference. The most is $24,000 from Olmsted County. They're the ones who are charging the most. And so it's not a huge amount, but I know that some of the counties have a bit of a concern about that. We also are proposing that the background studies be done by the Department of Human Services and that the state help pick up the cost for that. It would be about $600,000 for the first year to enter all of these providers and the people who live in their homes that are required to have background studies, their substitutes, into the system. The reason we think that this, and then it would fall dramatically and only include new ones after that, and children, like if a daycare provider has a 12-year-old and they turn 13, I believe is the age, that child has to be run through a background check, too, if they live in the licensed family daycare home. So there's always some little additions like that once somebody is licensed if they have children that are growing up. And we're asking the state to help pick up the costs. And the state is soon going to have access to some wonderful new BCA technology. It's being upgraded right now, should be online very soon. And they have been doing all of the center background checks. They have always been responsible for that. And so this would provide some consistency for all the child care, family and center-based, to have their background checks done by the state. And the advantage of this new state system is that once the information is entered, there's a kickback of information if anybody has a violation who is listed in there. And so you don't have to run a check every year like they are currently doing at the county level. Every year they have to enter all these people in again to make sure that nothing has been entered on their records in the last year. This would be an automatic way to review that. And we feel that is more ongoing and probably a better system of doing it. And I have with me today some of the people from the Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association to give you a little more information. I'll start with Beth.
My name is Beth Mork. I was previously the director for Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association. I'm currently retired. I came because this bill is very important to me as a parent, as a grandparent for people who are using child care. Again, I just want to reiterate what Senator Roebling said, in that we are, the licensed providers in Minnesota are not arguing that there should be a cost or a fee for licensing. They're just looking at the equity issue and making the license fee for being a child care provider equivalent to what you would pay if you were in a different industry based on the income that you're making and the occupation that you're doing. We also support the idea of the state doing the background checks for the idea of having that wraparound system where people would have that referred back if there was something that would show up on a background check. The part that you had in the kids' first handout, we want to reiterate that those are the 30 counties that are charging over what the license fee is that we're recommending, the $50 license fee. 57 counties have already implemented the $50 license fee or are charging less than what we're capping the licensing fee at in the state of Minnesota right now. So we already have two-thirds of the counties in the state doing what we're asking happens across the state. So we're just asking to make this more equitable and make it so that person who's across the street from somebody else living in a different county won't be paying a different fee for doing licensed care in their child care home. Minnesota has lost 1,000 licensed family child care providers since 2003 when these fees were implemented, which means that we're dropping the number of licensed homes. And according to our own resource and referral system, over half of the children that are being cared for in a home are being cared for in unlicensed homes, and that is a concern of ours. I mean, we really want to encourage people to at least maintain the minimum standards of licensing. A number of providers choose to care for very few children in their home. They may only want to take care of two or three children. And when you're doing that kind of child care, you know, the studies show that the quality of care is better when you're caring for fewer children. We don't want to discourage these people who are caring for low ratios of children from becoming licensed because of a licensing fee that might be prohibitive to them. We want to encourage that kind of care for children. So those are the points that I wanted to make, and I really want to thank you for letting me speak today.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Denise Welty. I'm a licensed provider in Olmsted County in Rochester. I've been a provider for 26 years. Family child care providers are a valuable asset to our communities and to the families we serve. When the state legislators passed this child care licensing and background check fees to some counties, including the one we are in today, Ramsey County, they decided, Ramsey, not to charge any fee. They realized the importance and value of the family child care providers and the service they provide to their communities, and decided to invest in the children in the future and not as a source for an additional funding for the county. In Olmsted County, where I live, family child care providers pay $250. That's the licensing fee and background fee. There's other counties that charge $250, but they only charge it every other year. In Olmsted, we pay it every year. We pay more than the Mayo Clinic doctors, and we pay over 13 times more than our school teachers over a five-year period. Your support for the licensing fee bill, House File 536, will help reinstore what should always be our top priority, our youngest Minnesotans. By having the state pay the background fees for providers and reducing the licensing fee to a fair and equitable amount for all providers across the state, this will help enable family child care providers to keep the level of care and quality at a high standard and be able to keep their doors open. And this should also allow for more individuals into the business. Thank you for your time today.
And Senator Roebling, we're really kind of focusing on the fiscal notes here. So my question to you is, can Section 1 of this bill go by itself? Would you want it to go by itself? We have the fiscal note, and we'll keep the rest here for consideration. But if we don't have room for it in the omnibus bill, would you like Section 1 to go by itself?
Well, certainly, Madam Chair, that would be better than not having any of it go, because at least we'd have the equity across the state and the licensing fees, even if we couldn't do the background checks. I know that I know you have some one-time money, and I know that the initial amount would be the most amount for the first year of entering all of these names into the system and having them come onto the state system. But certainly I would be happy to separate it if that would be helpful.
Are there any other questions? If not, then Senator Rosen, do you want to move that sections 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 be deleted from the bill? That would leave Section 1 that we could pass
Madam
on.
Chair, absolutely. Senate File 536 as amended would be...
Well, first we need to move that.
I move motion. That sections 2, 3, 4, and 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13 be removed from Senate File 536.
Any further discussion of that motion?
I think we may want to keep Section 13. Mm-hmm. It makes Section 1 effective. Section what? Doesn't Section 13 make Section...
Yes, we need to just delete part of Section 13. The part that would... the effective dates for the sections other than Section 1. So Senator Rosen incorporates that into her motion.
Sure.
Any other discussion? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question on that. If we do that, is there any... some of the things that I liked about Senator Roebling's bill is that it really kind of talks about what we're asking for in terms of licensing, what the expectations are and what's realistic. And so hopefully to help the counties, so to clarify a little bit more, I know I am that infamous Olmsted County. And so I think I like some of the provisions in the bill because it's trying to stimulate that conversation about what does it really mean when you are a licensed provider? Does that mean that you apply for the license and we put a stamp on there and say, great, thanks for your $50 and you're licensed? Or does that mean that, these 12 things happen? So I just pose that as
well, Senator Lynch,
we deal with
I believe
that.
Under Senator Roebling's bill that the counties would still be inspecting the family daycare licensed providers.
Yes.
I do have another bill to look at the whole, ask the counties and the department to look at the whole thing as to whose responsibility should be what. Over the interim, I'm hopeful that bill will pass, but I don't know if it will. But in the meantime, Section 1 could stand on its own. It doesn't mean we're not considering the rest of the provisions, but if we don't separate them, then it's possible that Senator Roebling would not have Provision 1 go forward either.
Madam Chair, I will support the amendment. I will also look forward to the continued discussion because I think that that will really get to the root cause and serve all counties and providers.
Any further discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I'd like to move Senate File 536 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
No, now you can move that it be recommended to pass.
Recommended to pass. Senate File 536.
Because all we have left in it now is Section 1. We have the rest of it here if we want to put it in the omnibus bill. But in order to facilitate Section 1, it can go on its own now.
I've made a mess of that, haven't I, Madam Chair?
Okay. So Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 536 as amended be recommended to pass. Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair and committee members, I want to thank you for letting Senate File 490 excuse me, be heard. I got to tell you, I'm really excited about this bill. It might not seem like it because it's kind of early in the morning, but I'm so excited about this bill it almost takes your breath away. But what this bill does is it modifies the group residential housing status and authorizes a supplemental rate not to exceed $700 a month for a 65-bed facility in Crow Wing County serving chemically dependent persons. And so, Madam Chair, I would immediately turn it over to Mr. Sherber from Teen Challenge to kind of lay out what we'd like to do and hope we can do. So, Mr. Sherber.
Welcome again.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Rich Sherber. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Teen Challenge. We would like to open a 65-bed facility for chronic inebriates up in and chronic drug users in the Crow Wing County area. We're looking to use the old Brainerd State Hospital building. We've been working with the Brainerd Lakes Area Development Agency, and we have a committee, a number of Crow Wing County board members, as well as the Sheriff's Department and a number of clergy, as well as businesses in that area that have requested our presence. We've been working on this for over 2 years. This supplemental service request is critical for us to start this facility. To give you a little bit of a history, some of this is redundant for some of you. There's 182 Teen Challenge centers across America. It's gained a reputation as being a very successful model for drug recovery. We deal with very chronic addiction. This is a 12-month program. You don't come into a 12-month program unless you have a very serious addiction. At any given time, over half of our adult residents, and this will be an adult facility, are sent to Teen Challenge as a diversion through the court systems, primarily the county courts. A lot of our residents are sent to the courts with very serious times. Many of you are aware of the fact that Minnesota's prison population is growing. Our county jails are full. And Teen Challenge, because it is a longer program, is a very largely used diversion program in the state. Essential parts about Teen Challenge, number one, is that our cost to run the program is around $2,700. If we get this supplemental service rate, it'll bring it up to what we will receive from the county is this basic $730, and then we're asking for a $700 supplemental service fee. We've been able to get this fee on most of all of our other beds in the Minneapolis area. The county has basically licensed us in Hennepin County as a facility with supplemental services because we do far beyond the basic group residential housing requirement. As I said, our costs around $2,700. If even with the supplemental service rate, we will be subsidizing the program at about $1,400 a month. So that means if we get the supplemental service rate, we'll get about $1,400 from the county, and then the balance will be appraised with private dollars. The history I talked about, we had members of the Brainerd Lake Development Agency came down to Teen Challenge, and they said there is a great momentum up in this Crow Wing County area. They want this bad. And as a result of this, they said, we see a great interest in coming alongside and helping. This is a win for the state in three ways. Number one is that all of the data out there shows that longer residential programs helping chronic addicts are a key to success. Number two is the cost savings. I've shared this before. I've got data if anybody wants to see it. A study that was done back in 2003 showed that the average cost for 30 days of treatment was over $11,000. I understand now it's close to $15,000 for 28 days of treatment. And the most number three is that studies show that Teen Challenge works. We just had Wilder Research look and finish a outcome study on Minnesota Teen Challenge. And we were interested in what is our data, what is our success. And we had Pat Owens, who works with she's wrote the textbook on outcome studies, also that's published by Hazleton Foundation, was part of this research study using the same uniform standards to determine outcomes nationally. The study found that 74% of adults who graduated were drug-free 6 months or longer prior to the survey. This also showed that 90% of our graduates were working full-time or attending school. And Pat Owens said these are very, very, very impressive outcome studies. We're not seeing these. And I brought three of our graduates. They're going to make it short, who are going to be sharing. They all three are from Crow Wing County, who had very, very, very serious addictions and have been sober for several years, and they're going to share their stories. So we'll start with Lisa.
Hi, my name is...
Welcome.
Thank you, Mrs. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Nguyen. I'm 30 years old. I've been a chronic methamphetamine and heroin user for the last 13 years. My addictions led me in and out of jails and to prison. I've had several suicide attempts, a couple accidental overdoses. Very well known by the police force up in that area, and I was told that there was no hope for me. I was never, ever going to be anything or make anything out of my life. I grew up with several hurts that I really didn't know how to deal with. I was molested, got teased a lot in school, didn't know how to deal with it. I turned to the wrong crowd, and I started doing drugs, and I started selling them. And about 19 months ago, I've been sober for 19 months now, and I graduated in January. This is the longest I've ever been sober. This is my seventh treatment. All the other programs that I've tried, including the long-term treatment program in prison, just it didn't do it for me. I felt there left like something was still missing. I didn't know how to get down to any of the deep root issues of my problems, and I ended up in jail facing 110 months in prison once again, And I got bonded out, and I decided to give this program a try because it was the only thing I hadn't tried was this longer-term treatment program. And I graduated in January, and I'm so happy. I'm a productive member of society. I'm going to college right now. I want to be a chemical dependency counselor and hopefully work at this facility and give back to the community I once helped destroy. My life is so full of hope. This program just seemed to have gotten all the things that I didn't get from the shorter-term programs. Thank you.
You're welcome. Questions? Thank you again for being willing to share your story with us. Jennifer?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer. I am also from the Brainerd Lakes area, and my story is similar with Lisa's. I dealt with meth addiction for 13 years. My meth addiction has led me in and out of jail since I was 18 years old. I've been in prison, and I've been in five, I believe, other treatment programs that just didn't seem to work. I also went through the treatment in Shakopee Prison, and that was a long-term treatment program, and that didn't work also. And I have been clean now for a year and a half, and I came into Teen Challenge just lost. I had tried to commit suicide a number of times, and I came in lost, and I graduated the program in July. Teen Challenge got to the root of my problem, what was causing me to use the drugs and alcohol, and I am now in college right now also. My lowest grade last quarter was a B+. And I just went in to speak at the VOA at Rosewood jails, and I knew girls that I was in prison there with, and they really, my testimony was very powerful to them. They had hope that they didn't have to live this life anymore. Thanks.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Seth?
Hi. I'll be real brief. I know you guys have a long day. My name is Seth Evans. I was a meth addict. I was a drug addict for several years. 15 years I was an intravenous user. I pretty much gave up everything that you could imagine for drugs. I'm from the Brainerd area. I should have told you that. I've been to prison. I've lost my family. And really, if there was anybody there had no hope, that was me. And I was allowed to go to Teen Challenge instead of going to prison. Crow Wing County allowed me to go there. And while I was there, I saw it as an opportunity. And I was able to learn why were the reasons that I turned to drugs instead of because of what problems were they, what were the roots of all my problems, and how to address them in a successful manner. And I have about 4.5 years of sobriety now, and this is the longest I've ever been sober, and I really don't think that I could have done that without Teen Challenge. The length of the program and what I was taught there were the key. The reason why I wanted to come here is because I've had 4 friends die in the past year because of drug and drug related situations, and really the problem in Brainerd concerning meth is just it's horrible. I'm watching, I've seen so many people hurt and die, and I can tell you that Teen Challenge is definitely a successful way to combat drug addiction. And so I just beg you to help this bill and help Teen Challenge. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Seth. Good luck to all of you in your recovery.
And Madam Chair, if I could just make a few comments. And, I think it's pretty clear, members, that what this bill does is really offers hope to a lot of people that are really in a bad state. the legislature in the last couple of years in putting the precursor drugs behind the counter. We've kind of did away with all the meth labs, but the meth is still coming in, and there's still a problem. And I would just say that you know, we've said Crow Wing County, but this facility is not only going to be serving Crow Wing County, it's going to be serving folks from Senator Olson's district up in Cass, Senator Saxhog's district in Aiken County, and in a whole surrounding area. Mr. Sherber, am I correct on that?
Yes.
This will be kind of a regional site that will serve a need for folks. So Madam Chair, again, this is I'm really excited about it. The community, Mr. Sherber talked briefly about this, but the community is really on board, and they really want to get this done. So with that, if there's no questions, Madam Chair, I would so move that Senate File 490 would be laid over for sure. or maybe possible, I guess. Okay, just trying to sneak that through if I could. But this is a great bill, Madam Chair. This is going to be my one of my number one priorities. So,
are there any questions? If not, you've heard Senator Coring's motion. Those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. The motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Senator Pretner Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 15. And all of you know I'm a practicing psychologist in a Duluth hospital, so I'm very familiar with our current healthcare system. And I see on a daily basis how our current complicated and fractured system of healthcare denies access to both the uninsured and the insured. Skyrocketing healthcare costs have made it increasingly difficult for employers to offer coverage. There are cost and access barriers to public programs. Minnesota has been moving backwards on covering our children. The number of uninsured children in Minnesota increased to 68,000 between 2001 and 2004. And the number of uninsured children ages 0 to 5, which are critical ages for children's development, increased by 11,000 during that same period. All children deserve access to quality, affordable health care, no matter where their parents work or how much their parents earn. Providing access to health care coverage and eliminating cost barriers to care are first steps to ensuring that Minnesota's children's health, helping them to thrive and to do well in life. Study after study shows that insured children are more likely to receive necessary care, less likely to miss school, and they perform better in school. Investing in our children's health is an important investment for Minnesota. And that is why I'm so proud to be the Senate author of the Children's Health Security Act, Senate File 15. This act will provide universal coverage for all children in Minnesota by 2010 in a two-phase approach. The proposal will create one large health care purchasing pool that will contain all the children from Minnesota families who wish to attend or participate. Under the Act, parents would pay no premiums, and their children would not be subject to co-payments or deductibles. Too often, high co-payments and deductibles curtail the ability of the insured to access health care and to seek the treatment that they need. I am also excited about this proposal because I am a strong advocate of primary prevention when it comes to health care. Leaving illness unchecked leads to far more costly health ailments. Our current healthcare system is inefficient and fractured, and we often end up dealing with patients seeking care for illnesses only after they have progressed and once their treatment has become devastatingly expensive. This is especially true for children. We have too many children without the right immunizations and prevention treatments. The Minnesota Children's Health Security Act will improve children's access to primary prevention and health screening, which will promote healthier children. Therefore, we will achieve cost savings in the long run. In addition, the Children's Health Security Act will produce savings in the healthcare system by eliminating the more than $70 million in uncompensated care for children. Another key aspect of this bill is that we will move away from employer-based coverage. Under this bill, parents will no longer have to worry about how changing jobs or being laid off will affect their children's health care. They will no longer have to change health plans. They can keep the same doctors and the same coverage for their children, regardless of their employment status. Universal health care coverage for children is an investment in children's health, the health care system, and Minnesota's future. And I believe that now is the time that we must act. And, Madam Chair, I have the A7 amendment, which is actually a delete-all amendment. It doesn't change it that much, but it does. Maybe we should pass out the A7 amendment.
It has been distributed.
Okay, these are changes are largely suggested by DHS to align the program more closely with medical assistance for the waiver purpose, and it will allow the department to apply for an amendment to the existing waiver. I can walk through portions of it. Section 2 increases eligibility for children under age 2 to 305% to capture the SCHIP dollars, 305% of the family or the federal poverty guidelines. Section 6 deals with eligibility. Section 8 says there are no premiums or cost sharing. Section 9 has to do with the application procedures and determination of eligibility. Section 11 sets the payment rates, which would be at least 3% higher than MA rates and 5% higher for prevention services. And this rate increase is included to ensure the providers who are taking on a larger population of children in public programs are adequately reimbursed. This section also states that the commissioner shall establish a care coordination performance bonus rate to help so that it will give them an incentive to keep children healthy, to provide the appropriate prevention services. Section 16 has to do with outreach grants to ensure that children know about it, the parents know about the program, and enroll them. Section 18 establishes the Legislative Task Force on Children's Health Coverage. And it provides that they would plan for the second phase and make recommendations on a healthcare delivery system that contains cost, ensures access to medical and preventive services, increases utilization of prevention services, incorporates best practices to improve health outcomes, and reduces health disparities among minority populations. And, Madam Chair, I am seeing the fiscal note for the first time about half an hour ago. And I know it's costly, but quite frankly, I'm impressed that it's a lot less than I expected it to be. And I would also like to emphasize the fact that there are a lot of similarities to Senate File 2. And so if Senate File 2 were incorporated, I believe that our fiscal note would decrease also because some of the charges in here are the same as in Senate File 2.
Senator Prettner-Solon, since you're calling our attention to the fiscal note, I also, in addition to the cost, which, of course, we don't have the money to do this, but in addition to that, I notice on the fiscal note that the total number of children that would be enrolled by 2011 would be 271,000. But of that, only 27,600 would be previously uninsured children.
That is correct.
So, you know, the vast, vast majority of the cost of the bill would be for covering children that today have some insurance at least.
Yes, Madam Chair, that is true. And, it really is a vision we're putting forward, a vision that would hope to cover all children. And it sets up the policy and the structures for this. I think the important thing to recognize is that we do have to have discussions about what we're willing to pay for children's health care, for everybody's health care. This is a problem that our state is facing, that our nation is facing. But we also have to look at, while this looks costly on the surface, the parents just under this bill will be saving upwards of $200 million per year in premiums and out-of-pocket costs. Employers will save nearly $200 million per year in premiums, and that uncompensated cost cares for, or care costs for children are more than $70 million that we will be saving. So there are some significant savings that could be accrued from this. That doesn't even talk about the administrative savings that would result from efficiencies of streamlining the existing public programs. And finally, we haven't begun to quantify the savings that would result from ensuring that all children have access to preventive care and investing in children's health at an early age. So I understand it's very costly, Madam Chair, we've struggled with whether or not to propose a tax for this. I think that that needs to be the will of the legislature. But even imposing a tax, in the long run, it will cost less for the citizens of Minnesota than it does now. And, Madam Chair, first I should offer the A7 amendment.
Yes. Senator Pretner-Solon moves her amendment.
Madam Chair, before we do so, I know that in constructing the A7 amendment, there were some pieces that were inadvertently omitted. There were pieces you wanted in there that segregate the Minnesota Care piece out of there, and I think that Ms. Kavanagh is ready to give those oral amendments to this A7 amendment.
Madam Chair, on page 1, line 8, after the period, we would insert, the commissioner shall not transfer any funds from the Health Care Access Fund to the Children's Health Security Account, period. And then on page 8, line 3, we would delete, and Minnesota Care dollars.
Okay, so Senator Pretner-Solon incorporates those changes into her amendment. Are there any questions on the A7 amendment? Seeing none, those in favor of the A7 amendment say aye.
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 Those opposed, the amendment is adopted.
And Madam Chair, I have Jim Koppel here from the Children's Defense Fund and Dr. Gerald Gilchrist, a pediatrician, to address you briefly on this.
Great. If they could come up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning, and thank you for allowing me to address you on a topic about which my colleagues and I feel so passionately. My name is Jerry Gilchrist. I'm a retired pediatric oncologist. I'm former chair of the Department of Pediatrics and Adolescents at Mayo Clinic. I was in active practice and involved in teaching and research for over 40 years, mainly dealing with kids with cancer and other devastating illnesses. Today, I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics and strongly in support of the position of the Children's Defense Fund. I should mention that our organization is called the American Academy of Pediatrics and not the American Academy of Pediatricians. And that was carefully chosen because our focus is on the welfare of children. The welfare of pediatricians is important, but they take second place. I moved to Minnesota in 1971 and was enormously proud of our state's commitment to the healthcare needs of children, who, as you know, are the most vulnerable and unrepresented members of our communities. You've heard the figures from Senator Solon on the almost 70,000 uninsured, the 11,000 in the critical age group 0 to 5, an increase in 11,000 amongst that critically important group. Today's children are our future. They're an investment in their well-being, And that kind of investment in their well-being sets the stage for a strong workforce and a thriving economy well into the future. I think you're all familiar with the findings from the Federal Reserve Bank regarding the benefits of early childhood education. There's no question that early childhood education and good early childhood health care are closely tied in with one another. I personally work with these children every day as an inner-city first-grade tutor. And I can tell you that they cannot afford the frequent absences that result from the difficulties their parents have in accessing primary and preventative health care. Their illnesses before health is sought seem to go on, and they take longer to recover because access and availability is just not that easy for them to find. Of course, as you've also heard, the lack of health coverage is one thing, but there are some enormous barriers that are created by our fragmented healthcare system. Co-pays, deductibles, 4-month waiting period for children to access Minnesota's healthcare program, and the long, often duplicative and confusing application forms. These barriers lead to fragmented preventative care, delayed diagnosis and treatment, and the resulting potential for chronic and sometimes fatal disease. In young children, leukemia often presents with similar initial symptoms to common cold. Access to a well-trained health professional can separate those out early and make for early treatment. Reliable access translates to more effective disease and accident prevention and to better management of chronic disease. When the only option for a family's primary care is the emergency room, cost, quality, and the coordination of care all suffer. It's well known healthier children have fewer school absences. Their parents and employers lose fewer work days. We truly need a comprehensive benefits package for children in the state with high-quality health care and improved access. Only then will every Minnesota child have the opportunity to achieve full potential, as well as normal growth and development. Members of the committee, Madam Chair, we can't let them down. Thank you for allowing me to address you on this issue. I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Doctor. Are there questions? Mr. Koppel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the director of the Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, which is a nonprofit child advocacy organization. I appreciate the opportunity today to address the committee in support of Senate File 15. And just to briefly summarize why we have been pushing this bill now for several years. This is our greatest opportunity this year, and we appreciate the fact that there's been the support that the Senate has provided to date. This bill is expensive, and the reason it's expensive is because it is actually a solution to a problem. And the real problem in today's healthcare for children is we have an eroding private sector coverage. It's a huge burden for employers to find affordable coverage that has appropriate care for children. And what I mean by that is to find affordable coverage, you often have to sacrifice benefits, co-pays, deductibles, leaving an expensive package, and therefore it's not accessible. The employees pay an increasing burden because they have to pay the premiums or share those costs, and it's pretty much a 50-50 proposition when it comes to affording family health care when you're a parent and an employee. As a result of all of that, we have fewer kids covered increasingly every year through private coverage. We have more and more kids underinsured in private coverage because they're buying compromised coverage. And we don't have a system with one simple goal, which is the children will be healthier. The goal of Senate File 15 and what the system as a result of Senate File 15 is that we would give children the health care opportunity we give them in education. Every child would be guaranteed coverage from the time they're born through the age of 18. And that means that every child grows up as healthy as they can be. It isn't about where they get their coverage, whether one employer pays it or another, whether there's a deductible or not a deductible, where their parents work or how much their parents make. It's about healthy children. When you look at all the polling data, everybody concurs that we should have healthy children, that every child should grow up with health care access. We just haven't figured out a way to do it. This is a way to do it. And it takes a consolidated effort, which means we are consolidating the program and consolidating the effort into one program, the result of which is there's great savings to employers who have been laboring with these premiums for years to cover children and cover them in inadequate ways in many cases. But it's a savings to them, and it's a huge savings to parents. The costs to those two entities go into this fiscal note. That's why this fiscal note is high. The cost is really just shifting those other costs into one publicly financed system for health care for all children. I hope that we are able to keep this vision alive. I think this is a solution to the problem. I think when you come up with solutions that work for all children, they merit the expense that they ask for. So I encourage the committee to adopt this legislation, to push it, and to work toward covering every child in Minnesota. Be a model again for the country. Thank you.
Mr. Koppel, by fiscal year 2011, the fiscal note shows 27,600 uninsured children would be covered. And we know that in 2004, we had about 78,000 uninsured children. So even if we had the money to spend on this bill, which we don't, we would not still get all of the uninsured children in the state covered.
Madam Chair, we had some extensive discussions about this, not this fiscal note because we just got it, but there was a similar fiscal note in the House. We got a couple weeks ago and had discussions with the department. And one of the things that I think we labor over and we argue over is no one's done this system. No one's tried to cover all children, no state in this country. You hear about them, but they're not practical. You know, Illinois has universal coverage for children with a 12-month uninsured requirement in order to be eligible. So there's a lot of rhetoric, but there's nobody that's really tried to do this. So as a result, we don't have good data on what happens. The reason there's 27,000 versus 67,000, for instance, is that the fiscal note reflects a churning, a continued churning in our system, that even though we go to 12 months continuous coverage, that kids drop off. If we don't have the 12-month, if you have every child participating in the system, the kids that are uninsured, which would mean the kids that are not accessing a program or signing up for the program, are coming in and are covered under presumptive eligibility, because as soon as they show up for care, their care is covered, their costs are covered, they're retroactively covered, and they're covered prospectively. So there is no child in Minnesota as a result of this bill that does not get the coverage they need. What we struggle with, and the same thing is true in education, when we provide education to all children, we struggle to keep all children in school. We struggle to give all children good education, and we will struggle to give all children good health care once we pass this bill. But the issue today is we can't keep kids in any program. We can't give kids accessible, affordable coverage. We don't know whether they're not showing up because they don't know how to use the health care system, or they're not eligible for the health care system, or they can't afford to copay for the health care system. So this removes all those barriers, leaves us with a challenge of keeping kids healthy, getting to families, doing the proper outreach, trying to do health education and keep kids as healthy as possible. And that is a challenge. And that's why these numbers don't reflect full, you know, full involvement of every family and every child. But that's the goal of this system. And until we do something like this structurally, we'll never get there.
Are there other questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Prittner-Solon, I was just wondering on the breakdown of the bill, since this is in the committee that we're looking at this, can you show me how much does it cost to insure the 19 to the 24-year-old students, if that's hasn't broken down? Do you know?
David Godfrey could show you on the fiscal note where it is, Senator Rosen.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, the section of the fiscal note that deals with the cost of covering financially dependent full-time students is found on page 8, and it's the last paragraph on page 8 and goes on to page 9. It has the total state cost for that beginning in fiscal year 09 of $151 million. Oh, I'm sorry. That's actually not correct.
14.
It's actually just a discussion of the full-time students in that paragraph, kind of three-quarters of the way down. It says cost to cover financially dependent full-time students. And Madam Chair, members, I'm going to need to speak with the department just briefly about this section.
Okay.
Can I answer for you?
All right. Well, maybe we can take another question. I'll come back to you, Senator Rosen. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to make certain for Senator Prittner-Solon that I understand for clarification purposes, this bill only covers or applies to families where a family of four where their income would be up to the maximum of $60,000. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the first phase of the bill to be implemented by
July 2008
would cover children that are at 300% of the federal poverty guidelines or less. And then the second phase.
And Senator Prittner-Solon, the fiscal note we have is just on phase one.
No.
Or is it on the
whole Chair,
thing?
I think you'll see the second phase is in 2011.
Right.
That you'll see a higher cost in that in the fiscal note when you go out for phase two.
Okay. Senator Olson.
So, Madam Chair, and so does the second phase change? The income limits go higher then, or
the second phase, Madam Chair and Senator Olson, covers all children in 2011.
And I'm assuming then, Senator Prittner-Solon, that covering the rest of the children would be without any federal funding.
That's true, Madam Chair. Without a match, you mean?
Without no federal participation.
Madam Chair, I don't believe that we would be eligible. You know, under federal law, you can establish, once you get your waiver, you can go as high in coverage, I believe, for children as you would like as a state. They can go up to 500, 600% of poverty. You just have to have approval. We don't, in this bill, we don't assume that. There isn't any federal match beyond the 300, but we would carry forward that 300 match up to 300. In the waiver.
Well, Mr. Godfrey.
Madam Chair, members, just going back to the fiscal note on page 8, the discussion of the full-time students begins on page 8, continues on to page 9. On page 9, it estimates the projected average enrollment of these individuals between 19 and 24 would be, again, in fiscal year 09 at there would be 3,442 of them. It would peak at fiscal year 11 at 19,000. Then going down further, the state share costs, which is the line right above the bold line there, it's 11, begins in fiscal year 09 as 11.9 million, and then tops at fiscal year 11 at 78.5 million for that population.
Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to make sure that we are using the fiscal note from the third engrossment, so we don't have a fiscal note for the A7. Is that?
I'm not sure if the fiscal note is to the fiscal note to the amendment or to the bill we had before the amendment.
I think it should be the same. It's essentially the same.
I guess we're informed that there isn't much difference.
Okay,
most of the changes in the amendment were technical.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to make sure just so that we had, and then I do have a question for Mr. Koppel, Madam Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
This is the cost right here.
Mr. Koppel?
No.
I'm sorry.
Member's asking you a question. You might want to listen.
Madam Chair, Mr. Koppel, you had mentioned in your statement that there was savings to the employers because they are now currently paying some of this family share. Now, my understanding is that, you know, a lot of the time, most of the time is that, you know, they may cover the employee and then the employee covers the family share. I was wondering if you had any numbers on that, what the breakdown would be, how many folks are in that situation.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Fischbach. There isn't, the data we have was when we use an actuary to preliminarily look at the impact of this bill. And so this would be estimated, but the estimated costs for that employers spend, and this would be on the phase one on children under 300%, the estimated employer premium is over $200 million a year. So that the employer, on average in Minnesota, when you look at those family policies, the employer pays about half of the cost of family policies. It's not always the total family responsibility. You know, they may cover the employee at a higher amount, and they maybe they'll cover the family at a lower amount. But on average, the employer pays slightly more than 50% of the premium for children, and the parent or employee pays slightly less than 50%. It's just about at a 50-50 proposition. So they both save about $200 million in phase one as a result of moving these premiums. The savings are equal to both.
And so,
Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, Mr. Koppel, you don't have any statistics for that second phase after 2010.
Madam Chair and Senator Fischbach, only statistic I could give you would be the Department of Health Economics, when they looked at in 2004 what we spent on children in Minnesota, we spent about $3 billion total on children's health care in Minnesota. And of that amount, parents pay about $1.1 billion, and employers pay about $870 million. So those would be potential savings of the, you know, depending on how many kids came into the program. But that, in terms of the over two-thirds of the cost in a healthcare system are employer and parent.
That would be the total possible savings.
Right.
Understanding that probably everyone would not enroll.
Well, and Madam Chair, and maybe Senator Pretner Solon can help me with this one. I guess I'm wondering, under phase two, if your family is offered private insurance, you have the option of going into that. And I guess what motivation does anyone have to keep their private sector on their children at that point? Because there may be a deductible, there may be a copay. And with the state plan, or under this plan, there's nothing. So I guess I'm guessing, I think everybody's kind of guessing at estimates on that second
on that second phase, but there's just no reason for anyone to keep any private sector.
Madam Chair, Senator Fischbach, I would hope not. I would hope that everybody would want their children enrolled in this plan, because this is a quality plan that really seeks to maintain the health of the child. And really, I'm hoping that this would be a model for expanding universal health care to our entire population. This is a good project or model to check on that.
Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, Senator Solon, Prettner Solon, we don't know if it's a good plan yet. I mean, it's on paper it may look really good, but we don't know what's going to happen with it. And we've already made the step to expand it to everyone in 2010 without even really trying it out. I mean, that's, I think, really really broad. Or it just kind of moves immediately into that. And so I have concerns. We really don't know what's going to happen. And I appreciate the fact that, you know, you've put together a bill that you think is going to work. But, you know, in so many times, we don't know what happens when we put it into law.
Madam Chair and Senator Fischbach, we are making some assumptions, but we are taking what are the best practices and the best parts of our health care system and putting them all together into one bill as we know it today.
And just one more follow-up question. Madam Chair, Senator Prettner Solon, would you, if it was just the first phase, are you really attached to that second phase, or I guess I'm just wondering, you know, because Madam Chair, Senator Prettner Solon, I guess I support the idea of covering uninsured children, but that second phase kind of moving on is what bothers me.
Madam Chair, Senator Fischbach, I know that's a hard swallow. That's a huge one. And I, of course, I love the whole bill, but I could accept perhaps the first phase with the study to see about expanding to cover the rest of children. The companion bill to this in the other body has a study rather than the expansion to incorporate the rest of the children.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson wasn't quite finished, I don't think.
Sorry.
That's okay. Are you done?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have first a question, and then I'd like to follow up with a comment to what Senator Fischbach had to say. And the reason I asked that earlier question, and I'm sorry I missed the information about the second phase, but I like the bill better. Maybe I'll make my comment first. I like the bill better with the second phase. I would just point out that this is voluntary in terms of parents' decision to enter into the program, and we will have had a couple of years for parents to be looking at this and seeing how it's working before they make the decision whether they want to come in the second phase. And I would be a little concerned without the second phase that parents above $60,000, say in the $60,000 to $100,000, are still very solidly in the middle class and are going to have to be partially subsidizing the cost of this first phase through their tax dollars. And by not having an opportunity to have that same benefit for their own children, it seems to me unfair that we might expect them to still having to be continuing to look at policies where they might have a $10,000 annual deductible, which is kind of the direction we're moving with healthcare right now, and still have a limited income that would not allow them to provide healthcare to their children, so that we will still not have realized the actuality of having all children in the state covered. So my concern would be that in fairness to business owners and families who are still very much in the middle class and having difficulty insuring their children, that they at least have the option. If, you know, I would not like something that did not give them this option. And then my actual question is getting down to just the dollars and cents of the wisest use of our money in healthcare, I'm wondering if you can tell us that if you have comparison numbers, and I know that in the private sector the cost of insuring a child or a person in general varies from policy to policy, but just on average, of the cost of insuring a child under your program for a year
per child as compared to under the average under existing programs we have today.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, when we did the study originally, we had an actuary come in and cost it out. It wasn't this same as a fiscal note on this bill, but it was broader numbers. And when they were looking at costs, privately covered children are fairly are much less expensive. The most expensive children to cover, the most expensive rate we have is the medical assistance rate. And then Minnesota Care is closer to the private sector in terms of the cost per year. So the privately covered kids and the Minnesota Care kids are comparable in terms of actuarially costing out their care. So the cost of bringing in private previously insured kids and privately covered kids into Minnesota Care is pretty lateral. It's, you know, it's not a big shift. We do have a reimbursement increase built into this bill, which does take care of any change in provider rates as a result of the shift. So there, you always have to monitor that to make sure that you're reimbursing providers at an adequate level so you have access to care. But the cost for the children in privately covered programs, private insurance, is roughly the same cost as Minnesota Care.
Senator Sharon?
I was listening so hard, I might have forgotten my question here. One of my comments was similar to Senator Olson in terms of, I think one of the difficulties that we have in a transitional program is that the persons who are not involved in the program are paying for the program plus paying for their own health care system, and that creates, in the transition period at least, and a differential in the burden. The long-term vision that this is moving towards, though, has everyone. I mean, we pay for health care either through our out-of-pocket expenses and premiums, and employers pay for it on the one end. So we're paying for it. It's just we're talking about what system through which we're going to pay for it. Do we want to transfer all that expenditure that we're making for health care over to supporting it through a tax system rather than through a premium or through personal insurance. And so I understand that long-term goal is to shift that over. It is that interim that I think is difficult to talk about. I would be curious to know, in phase one, what the essential difference is in terms of dollars between the phase one and the proposals for in Senator Berglund's bill, which really works towards covering those children who are already eligible and covers up to 80% of the children who are currently covered. What is the differential between those two?
Well, Madam Chair, I think that, and you can correct me, Senator Berglund, if I'm wrong, but I believe that your proposal incorporates about 20% of those children per biennium. Is that correct? So it would take a longer period of time to cover those children than this bill currently proposes.
Senate File 2's fiscal note had a little over 30,000 children covered. Some of them are children that are already eligible that we were doing outreach to get enrolled, and others were children that where we were expanding eligibility because perhaps they were underinsured or not eligible. But we were not making all children eligible for a medical assistance program. The expansion was for Minnesota Care, which has parents paying some premium for their children.
Is it, thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon, in phase two, if all children are covered, no matter what it's for everybody, it doesn't make any difference what the income is. So everybody's covered. I know you're saying it's voluntary, but if we're just conceptualizing the idea that everybody would be there, so our premiums and everything are going over into taxes to pay for supporting all children covered, is there... So no matter if you come to the emergency room, no matter where you come, it's assumed that this person will have health care. So there's all sorts of cost savings, it seems to me, in that, in terms of all this enrollment process and checking out what level of income you are and all of the state agencies that are required to figure out all these various funding sources, accepting that we still want to take advantage of the waiver program, correct? So in the long-term vision that you have, there still is an agency process that has to go on in order to be able to collect those revenue sources, correct?
Mr. Koppel will respond.
Senator, Madam Chair.
And then I'd just like to remind members that we do have a few other bills on the agenda today, and I don't have $700 million a year for this bill, so we will have a lot of time to discuss this idea along with a lot of other ideas this summer when we have the Healthcare Access Commission or whatever group it's going to be look at what all the ideas that there are for how we could get to universal coverage. Senator Sharon, did you get your...
No, I'm hoping that I'll be very involved and active in that process because I have a lot of questions, and I think it's hard to make a decision like this without some significant understanding of the implications of it. But I can lay my question aside if that would be helpful at this time.
Well, I think the short answer to the question is as long as we have medical assistance involved, there would need to be people applying to see if they're eligible, you know, if their income is under 300% of poverty and if they meet the other requirements.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Did I understand there's a study, a bill that has a study to study all this? And how much does that study cost?
I think all of the ideas are being, in the Senate at this point, are being referred to the Healthcare Access Commission to look at.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, in this bill there is a task force, and the cost is $97,000 the first year for that task force.
I understand that is to study phase two.
That is correct. Okay.
Any further questions, Senator Fischbach?
Madam Chair, given your last statements, I guess maybe it's not necessarily necessary, but I would like to offer the amendment to remove lines 2-9 and 2-10. And there's a study, and Senator Brettner-Solin mentioned that that's the way it was in the House bill. So I'd like to take that expansion out, this phase two. And so there would still be study or the commission in the second part of the bill that would study it. So until we've done that, maybe we should just pull those lines out.
Can you give us a page and line?
Oh, page 2-9 and 10. 2-9 and 10. It's the language on 2010 expanding the eligibility to everybody. Two lines.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
May I speak to that amendment? I don't know if that makes that more palatable for your committee. If so, I'd agree to it. But if you're not going to accept the bill, then I just soon keep those lines in the bill.
I'm not sure that we have the money for phase one either, so. But the committee, any member has a right to offer an amendment, and the committee can decide. Any further discussion of the amendment?
Not the amendment.
Any further discussion of the amendment? Senator Olson.
Well, Senator Berglund, I understand that at this point the money isn't in the budget. But by the end of the road and the end of the session, I guess that'll be a debate we may even end up having on the floor. So I guess I'm going to support the bill for possible inclusion, knowing the money isn't there now, but at least leaving it available to go forward for that kind of debate.
Right now we have an amendment. I'd like to stick to the amendment. Any further discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye. No.
Chair is in doubt. Will the ayes raise their hand? And the nays? Motion is not adopted. Any further discussion? Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you. I just want to make a comment, Senator Prettner-Solin. Thank you for the work that you put in on this bill and working with all the groups that support this bill. I just think we are at a crossroads in Minnesota history where we really have to look at the responsibilities that we have as a state. And I think health care is one of those. Health care is not a commodity. Everyone deserves health care. And there are many people in the state that don't have coverage, and we've heard a lot of testimony about even the uninsured and how they act as if they were uninsured. So I thank you for bringing us this bill. We do have to struggle with the funding mechanism, and yet I'm looking forward to phase three, which I hope is covering everyone. And there's many universal health care bills in, and I think that's the great goal. The question is, which path do we take to get there? So thank you very much for bringing this bill.
Thank you.
Any further discussion?
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Prettner-Solon.
I would like to move that Senate File 15, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Now, I know that you probably aren't going to accept the whole bill, but you may. That's a disappointment to me that we might choose not to implement the whole bill. But there, I believe that there are many portions of this bill that might be helpful and portions that could be included if possible. I'd like to have it there for discussion.
You've heard the motion. Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion is adopted.
Thank you. Thank you.
Senator Sharon?
Madam Chair, I would just point out the fact that Senator Scogin has been here for a while and has a bill up.
We can take him next.
He's right here behind me.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. I did not see you back there, Senator. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We would have come to get you when we were ready for you. So in the future, you don't need to feel like you have to sit through our whole committee. But it is a very interesting committee to hear the bills that are here.
The last 90 days have been very interesting, so I didn't mind at all sitting through that. Madam Chair, committee, I'd ask you to turn your attention to Senate File 1742, and I just want to start by thanking you, and I know our time is short today, but this came to us late in the session, and Madam Chair, I want to thank you for taking the time to hear this particular bill. I also want to start, I believe an A2 amendment is being handed out at this time, and that would put the bill in shape for me if I could get Senator Coring to offer that A2 amendment for me, I would appreciate it.
Madam Chair, I would offer the A2 amendment.
Right, and it's in our packets, members. So,
Madam Chair, I would offer the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that Senator Scogin would like.
Any further discussion of the A2 amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you. As the title of the bill implies, Senate File 1742, a committee and Madam Chair, provides a pre-designed funding for a multi-county regional secured treatment facility out in west central Minnesota. You're all aware of the difficulties that counties have in dealing with increasing pressures on courts, jails, family services, and this bill represents an attempt by 11 rural counties who have come together to try to ease the costly cycle of addiction and concurrent incarceration by pooling their resources to provide treatment to inmates at the county level. I've worked with the group for some time on this project, and we're pleased to be able to present it to you today. I have several testifiers, or actually two today, who can provide further details and hope that you can give them your attention and your support. I would like to introduce Todd Schneesberger. Todd is a Grant County Commissioner who has worked on pulling the 11 counties together. And Ted Redmond is here. He will be the architect on the project and on the needs study. And with that, Madam Chair and committee, I think I'll turn you over to Todd Schneeberger for just a real quick opening comment about what this means to the 11 counties that are involved in this program.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for hearing us today, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you. My name is Todd Schneeberger. I am a Grant County Commissioner out in western Minnesota. And our county is involved in a three-county public health system, which or public health organization, which was started about 3-4 years ago. And all of us have jail problems and shortage of treatment physicians and those kinds of issues in smaller counties and lack of funding to hire those kinds of services for our people individually. And as we meet as multi-county units, this discussion came forth a couple years ago, and we started with 10 counties meeting and trying to come together in an agreement of how to go forward and how to solve these problems. And as we went along, we added the 11th county, and we've been working with BKV Group and TED. And if you refer to, there's a couple handouts in your packet. One is from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, titled Substance Abuse Treatment. And if you look at the key recommendations in there, both for the Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections, our goals and hopes and mission in our project, a lot of those recommendations are in what we've talked about for the last 2 years, which makes us feel good about the direction we're heading and the direction that some of the state offices are recommending us that we move forward in. And the second handout is our pre-design work plan summary, and we have had local county funding that's been implemented and has funded the project to this point. I think I will turn it over to Ted. We did a feasibility study initially to determine the necessity and the need, and I'll turn it over to Ted to talk about that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Ted Redmond with BKV Group Architects, and I'm very excited to be here to talk to you about this project today, primarily because I think of anything that I've ever been involved in, collaboration is very much a part of this effort. Collaboration not only from the fact that we have 11 counties that are together, but the reality is that we are actually looking at creating an approach which is in a collaborative approach, combining the justice process and the jail process and the treatment process. The feasibility study that we were initially asked to do starting 18 months ago was to assess the needs of this 11-county region from those two perspectives separately, from a jail bed space need, just pure and simple jail bed, as well as from initially a meth treatment, which quickly evolved into understanding that meth was one component of chemical dependency. What came out of that feasibility assessment was an understanding or a recognition that we have some excellent infrastructure in place, but there are some cracks that people are falling through. Specifically, the treatment process and programs that are in place that are very successful in the state of Minnesota tend to catch people at the end of a certain cycle. What we're discovering as we are working with the jail folks is that those people that end up being captured, if you will, with the treatment process often get cycled through the jail process over and over and over again before they actually get the point of being able to have that treatment provided to them. There's a number of reasons why that happens, and we're working now as a part of our pre-design effort to understand that more fully. Part of those reasons are that some of these counties, frankly, are small enough that the numbers of people that they have that might be going through the system are small. It's one or two people a day, you know, at any given point in time. Others have more. They're 8, 9, 10 people at a time. That means that providing treatment while in jail is extremely difficult to do because you need enough density to be able to support the staff necessary to provide quality treatment. The other reasons that are related to this are the fact that we have two systems that, although certainly speak to each other very well, they are focused on slightly different aspects of the same issue. This process that we're embarking on is to try to create an operational paradigm that captures, takes that treatment and moves it as far to the beginning of that cycle as we can possibly get it. Ideally, as soon as somebody was booked, if they have treatment needs, we try to get them into it. That's the thought at this point in time. The pre-design effort is focused right now on developing a much more solid operational understanding on how to basically fill the holes that some of these folks are falling through.
And, Senator, this is not a bonding year.
Correct.
And this is a bonding request. So what usually will happen is we had no bonding requests that were going to be able to be considered this year, so we didn't send any recommendations to Senator Langseth's committee. But next year, we will have a number of bonding bills, and we will give him recommendations about prioritizing them. And then the actual appropriation of any bonding dollars would take place in his committee. So for that reason, we'll probably be just laying this over to look at it next year. And because we have a few other bills on the agenda, I'm going to ask members if they can keep their questions brief, and if you need to come back next year to give us greater explanation, we can do that.
Madam Chair, thank you. You'll see in the appropriation in Section 1 that line is blank, although people working on this project feel that they would need about $300,000 to complete the study and put the report together. Senator Langseth has indicated that if this committee is willing to send it on to capital investment this year, he would take a look at it and see if he could find us that money for this year. So I guess, Madam Chair and committee, that's what I would look. If you are willing to give us the okay to move ahead, we will go and talk to Senator Langseth and his committee about possibly some inclusion.
Okay. Well, I certainly have no objection to that, if that's what the committee would like to do.
Madam Chair.
We stand for questions.
Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Did you have?
I was going to make a motion.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Scogin, I support the direction that this bill is going.
Thank you.
Because I think it's wonderful when different jurisdictions come together and utilize the facilities that they have in place. And I love what Mr. Redmond was saying about how you need to look further into how to make this facility work. My question, though, Senator Scogin, is $300,000 to do a study, a pre-designed study? Did I understand you correctly? Because $300,000 could actually go quite far in the counties to just get the program up and running without having to study it.
I would hope so, and not being one who does studies, that was a number that was given to me, and that's why I offered that $300,000. Maybe our architect could give us a little better idea on what that money would be spent on and why it would be that much.
Yes, Madam Chair, what I could clarify is that as a pre-design document, you have the traditional sort of pre-design effort that is necessary, but in addition to that, which often you might find running in the $100,000 to $150,000 range, depending on the type of project, for this project in particular, because the operations of the facility is essentially a new entity, something that has not quite been seen before in this form, an operational programmer, which is a specialty consultant that would be made available to help create an actual treatment model and program. Combined with the judicial process to establish an operational model for the project is the remainder of that funding.
You know, it's a starting, Senator Rosen and Madam Chair, it's a starting point, and I'm sure flexibility is going to be in our mind as we move forward. This is kind of new for us, too.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am just a little befuddled. I think the concept is excellent. I would actually like to change part of this bill and scratch out pre-design, because I do think there is a wonderful wealth of knowledge out there that is free. And I would recommend contacting Tom Rimey from Olmsted County, who has a treatment program in a secured jail setting that would be he would step up to the plate to help with any of these questions and help get your program going. So, I mean, if we were going to appropriate any money, I would like to see the program up and running instead of using it for a pre-design. That's just so, Madam Chair, I would like to scratch the word pre-design on page 1, line 6, and to fund a fund to the Commissioner of Human Services for a multi-county regional secure treatment facility, because
This would still be bonding dollars to build a facility. Do you have any idea what the cost of building the facility would be?
Madam Chair and Committee, not until the study is done to see what that 11-county area would need.
So I think maybe deleting that language would be premature at this point.
Madam Chair, Senator Scogin, is there not a site available right now, or is this going to be a brand-new facility?
Gentlemen, correct me if I'm wrong, but Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, this would be a brand-new facility. Mm. We have a couple of ideas where we might put it in an 11-county area. You know, the counties have talked this over, but there is no building.
And I guess the other questions that we would have either here or in the other committee would be, will there be operating dollars to make sure this facility can operate if it is built? And would there be a local match on any of the construction dollars? Has that been discussed with the consortium of counties involved in this project?
Madam Chair, that is under discussion, you know, currently, and part of the, until we get some numbers with the, you know, and get through the pre-design and we know what costs are, then we would be prepared to answer those questions in a more accurate manner. It would be pure speculation at this point until we get through this pre-design phase.
Then I guess the second question is, would there be any local contribution to the pre-design?
Madam Chair, there has been already. All 11 counties have put money in to move it to this point, and there's some money.
How much have they put in?
To date, we've contributed between the 11 counties. We've contributed $75,000.
Would there be any contribution then toward the cost of the pre-design, or is the $75,000 the maximum contribution?
At this point, that's all we've asked for, and we're working with the, if you look at the handout with the pre-design work plan summary, the money that we have collected at up to date gets us through numbers 1 through 7 in that handout, and that's we're right in the middle of that right now. So I guess moving forward, it's not necessarily maxed out, but that's where we are to this point, and what the steering committee has asked counties for contribution.
Okay, any other discussion? Senator Solon?
Madam Chair does raise the question of a match, and usually the bonding committee looks for a one-to-one match on projects.
So you might want to be thinking about that.
Madam Chair and Senator Pretner Solon, I believe when we get in front of Senator Langseth, that question will come up.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen?
I wish this entire concept the best. I think this is the direction that we need to go, especially out in greater Minnesota, where you see collaboration between all these different jurisdictions. And perhaps you will be willing to share your information and your process with other areas that are looking at doing something similar to this, because this is a very viable option for treatment. And I certainly hope you look at the aftercare issue thoroughly, too. That's where you're going to find the success in all this. So,
thank you,
Madam
Rosen.
Chair, I'd move the A2 amendment of Senate File 1742.
It's already been adopted.
It's been adopted. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I'm not going to mess this up.
one last question from me, Senator, and that is this really a treatment jail, or is it a treatment facility? I mean, it's going to be secured, and the impression I get is it's going to be an alternative to incarceration.
If I understand the intent, Madam Chair, of the design, they'll be looking at people who have committed crimes, generally because they were under the influence and they were going to receive incarceration anyway. The intent now will be to begin treatment while they are incarcerated, probably in that 12 to 18 month, maybe 24 month time period, and so we won't see them back in the system.
So then, I guess the question that I have is funding for this appropriate to come through the Department of Human Services, or would it be more appropriate to come through the Department of Corrections?
I wanted you to see it, Madam Chair, because of the treatment aspect. And I appreciate that you did.
The state does not fund treatment in jails. Not this committee, not Senator Higgins' committee. We do have, there is some funding in Senator Higgins' budget for short stays that otherwise would be committed to the prison system. But we fund treatment for counties to provide services to people who are in the community. We don't provide funding through this committee for people that are incarcerated.
And I believe Senator Rosen may have touched on it, Madam Chair, in that it is new and it is something that Senator Langseth wanted to see how this committee reacted to it, to be very honest with you. He asked me to bring it here, and he said if you can get some good response, he would be willing to talk to us about it. And so I'm doing it also as not a favor, but as a response to Senator Langseth.
Sure. Well, I'm not sure that the Department of Human Services is the right place myself. I think they might be the right place to provide technical assistance in regard to treatment, or maybe even the Department of Health might be the place to provide technical assistance to the counties in regard to the treatment they would establish. But building something that's sort of like a jail isn't really something the Department of Human Services.
Madam Chair, could I ask you to send us over to Senator Langseth's committee, and if he has a problem with who has seen it, I mean, we maybe have other stops on the way.
Sure. Well,
Madam Chair.
Senator Corrin.
Madam Chair, I would make, first of all, I believe Senator Rosen made a motion. I'm wondering if she withdrew it to delete something out of it.
Oh.
Okay.
I moved the A2.
Did she withdraw?
I moved the A2, but it was already moved.
Well, you were going to delete something from the A2 amendment, but
that?
I think she withdrew
that
amendment.
Okay. Thank you.
And then, so, Madam Chair, if there's no other questions, Senator? No? So, Madam Chair, if there's no other questions, I would so move that Senate File 1742 as amended be recommended to pass. I think Senator Scogin has heard some of our comments. I think it's going to be a work in process, but I would so move that it would be sent to the Committee on Finance.
Okay, you've heard the motion, and Senator, when Senator Langseth asked for our reactions, you can tell him that I'm not sure it belongs coming through the Department of Human Services.
I appreciate that, but to the motion, I was more interested in having it go to capital investment.
Well it has to go back to the full finance committee
first,
and then
first
go over
and,
to
and then re-referred.
Because we're just a division. We can't send things directly anywhere else. So, any further discussion on that motion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Senator. Senator Sharon. We can stay in this room today until 12:15. If your schedules will permit, we might be able to get through our agenda then. Not encouraging anyone to take longer than they need to, however.
Senator Thank Sharon. You, Madam Chair. I'm here to present Senate File 384. I know that our time is short. We're talking really about an appropriation here of $200,000. And so to keep it brief, I've asked our testifiers to talk about the essence for which this money is being asked and ask that it be laid on the table to be considered in the omnibus bill. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to our presenters this morning, and we can begin with your permission, we can begin with our testimony right away.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. And thank you for the opportunity to discuss how Minnesota can create a complete system of support for all families with children who are deaf and hard of hearing. I'm the parent of a child who is deaf and privileged to be the coordinator of the Family Support Connection at LifeTrack Resources. Today, I ask for your support for $100,000 in annual partnership between our program and the Minnesota Department of Health. The Family Support Connection was started at LifeTrack Resources in 2000 primarily as a metro service through private funding provided by the Greater Twin Cities United Way. For the past 5 years, the Minnesota Department of Health's Universal Newborn Hearing Screening and Early Intervention Program has contracted and partially funded the Family Support Connection. And as you may know, a mandate for newborn hearing screening is before the legislature at this time, as are many other bills to support families who have children with hearing loss. What we cannot legislate is a parent's reaction to the news that their child has a permanent hearing loss, or that parents will be able to move beyond their feelings of grief, isolation, especially in Greater Minnesota, and feeling of inadequacy to advocate and make decisions for their child. However, we can legislate financial support for trained parent guides to help parents beyond their grief. The Family Support Connection's parent guides provide parents firsthand emotional support and provide unbiased information about all options and can link families to one another and give them access to experts in the field. All this support means parents are better equipped to make decisions for their child earlier. And with 50% of our children lost to follow-up and not returning for diagnostic workup, we need to address this issue head-on. Last year alone, we provided services for 492 unduplicated parents and professionals with recurring funding support for just over one full-time equivalent. The need has been demonstrated. The program has been successful. In 2006, the Family Support Connection expanded to include trained parent guides in every region of Minnesota. And partial funding from the Department of Health ends in 2008 now and does not fully even finance the program as it stands. While corporate and other foundations have helped support this project, consistency and continuation of the program requires a public investment. In particular, funding for families in Greater Minnesota is at risk. These families deserve the same access to services as families in metro communities. With estimated special education costs for just one late identified child at around $400,000, early diagnosis and successful intervention for even one child would more than pay for the full cost of the Family Support Connection in 1 year. We ask for your small investment in the future of our children who are deaf and hard of hearing and to consider a full and necessary package of support for all Minnesota families. And I invite you now to listen to one parent's story. I introduce to the committee Chris Hemstock, our Southeast Parent Guide.
What was that? Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kristen Hemstock, and I'm from Mankato. I'm the parent of an 8-year-old son with hearing loss. Despite failing numerous newborn hearing screenings at birth, my son Carter was not diagnosed with his hearing loss until age 5 1/2. Unfortunately, we were one of the families who fell through the cracks. The school and our audiologist presented communication and educational options available to us, but something was missing. What really would have helped us to navigate those first few months better was another parent. Another parent who had been there before us, someone to share their experience with us, to let us know what worked for them and how to go about achieving it, to encourage us and to help connect us as only a parent can. Over time, we were able to connect with a couple of other families, and what a blessing it was to talk with someone who knew just how we felt, who felt the same urgency about how important this was for our children's future. Parents who had the same life aspirations for their child with hearing loss. Because of this, I became a parent guide for Southwest Minnesota. I work with families who are trying to navigate this overwhelming time. I offer support, encouragement, connections to other families, and connections to local resources. Most of these families know no other families who share their experience. Many live in rural areas and feel very isolated. Having a statewide parent network and a trained parent who knows the resources of each community is so very necessary. Professionals can deliver necessary information. Parent guides can motivate other parents to take action and to be living proof that they can and will have successful children. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is $100,000 in each year of the biennium, so it's a total of $200,000. And I think really, for very little money, creates a substantial connection and training for parents who volunteer to go and stay connected and help families with this adjustment process. So I'm hoping that
I could make the motion unless there are some questions to...
Are there any questions?
To lay this over then, to be considered in the omnibus bill.
Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 384 be recommended to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Members, I am going to make kind of a decision here. We do not have a fiscal note for Senator Higgins' bill. And I think at this stage of the session, it is pretty difficult to discuss a bill without having a fiscal note in front of us. So I'm going to make a decision that that bill will be laid over until tomorrow's agenda. Hopefully then we'll have a fiscal note. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm happy to be here this morning representing Senate File 848, which would increase funding for three senior core programs of Minnesota. These are proven cost-effective programs that are working for our senior citizens and, in one case, also for the youngest people in Minnesota. Speaking to this bill are Mark Kuha, a friend of mine who is a program manager for Lutheran Social Services in Walker, and Bob Dingley, who's a real volunteer in the Senior Companion Program. So I think I'll turn the mic over to Mar Kuha.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this time. I'm excited to talk about the Senior Corps in Minnesota. My name is Mar Kuha, and I'm from Walker, and I am Senator Olson's constituent, and I thank you for this time. I'm here representing three programs, the Senior Companion Program, the Foster Grandparent Program, and the Retired and Senior Volunteer Program. We are asking each of you to support Senate File 848, which will restore and increase funding to these very proven cost-effective programs. And I know that many of you are very well acquainted with these programs, but just a quick overview. Foster grandparents work with special needs kids, at-risk youth all over the state, providing hours and hours of service to change their lives. Senior companions serve as friendly visitors, advocates. They provide transportation. They provide really important respite care to folks who are care providers. They just do a lot of things that keep people living independently in their homes and out of nursing homes, which is so much our goal. And Retired and Senior Volunteer Program volunteers, they use their diverse talents in things like building homes, repairing homes, tax assistance, assistance to new immigrants, and emergency response, and just a myriad of opportunities. These programs save us money. They are results-orientated, and on any given day, my friends, 17,000 volunteers are touching lives out there in this state, making a difference. Minnesota has a history of supporting these programs, but our last increase was in 1996, and in 2003, we received a 15% cut, and that meant, according to the Minnesota Board on Aging, that in the first 6 month period after that cut, about 3,900 people fewer were served by our programs. And I can't really speak to what two of the programs, the actual effect, but I do know that with the Senior Companion Program in Minnesota, because of those cuts, we were unable to serve 210 clients we previously had served. We believe, and we have some good evidence to support it, that 25% of those folks went to the nursing home. Now, we don't suggest that we do this alone. We work with public health agencies, Meals on Wheels, and all kinds of other senior services. But for many folks, senior companions are the only resource they have. If you do the math on that, and you know it better than me, and a nursing home costs $40,000 a year, that's $2.5 million in 1 year that someone paid to foot that bill. Current funding for the Senior Corps is $1.78 million, and Governor Pawlenty has proposed a 2% cost of living, and that will give three programs covering the state a $36,000 increase to put that new budget at $1.8 million. We are requesting $1 million per year for each program. That will light a fire under the Minnesota Volunteer Programs. This would really be the same as if we had got a 3% cost of living over the last 11 years. And briefly, what it will buy, our volunteers drive their own cars. They rely on transportation. We often aren't able to reimburse that mileage. And I paid $2.52 a gallon for gas yesterday coming down from up north. This is an issue for our volunteers. We would increase that mileage reimbursement. We would target foster grandparent sites where the youngest of the Minnesotans, early childhood, are needing experience and love and affection and mentoring in those classrooms. Senior companions would work hard to keep people off of the waivered programs, to keep people in their homes, and to expand our services. And the Retired and Senior Volunteer Program, this new money would enable more volunteers to support independent living in the older population. The money would primarily be used to reimburse costs such as serving home-delivered meals, respite, and transportation programs. Our programs have a history of partnering with other agencies. We're able to capture dollars both from in-kind contributions from the partner agencies, from United Way dollars, and part of that is Minnesota's commitment to giving us these dollars that help us capture those other dollars. We will be the go-to people for the volunteer force of Minnesota. We always have been a piece of that continuum, and we want to continue to do that. And as I said, you have the possibility to really light a fire under that. Right this very minute, this morning, in Crow Wing County, Mike Keckler, the RSVP director, he's connecting transportation people. He's getting people to dialysis. He's using volunteers. This morning in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, there's a woman who is calling 20 to 30 people to ask them if they need food in their homes. She puts together a network of shoppers who pick up the groceries, do the order, and deliver it. And you can bet there's a little visiting happening. This morning at Central Elementary in Bemidji, Minnesota, Grandma Catherine is working with a young man who is a fourth grader. His age says he should be a seventh grader. And in 2 months, she took him in one half hour of reading work. She took him in grade level in reading beyond what he established or what he was able to meet in 2 years of classroom. These folks make a difference. Jean in Southern Cass County this very minute is calling public health to say that one of her clients is taking her meds, and it saves a trip of a public health nurse down to the southern part of the county, which is a real haul of about 60 miles. These volunteers are worth a million, and I want you to meet a real one. Thank you for your time.
Members, I'm sure you can see why Mark Kuha is so well-known in our area. She's extremely passionate about what she does, and we're really very fortunate to have her. So I'll now pass the microphone over to Mr. Dingley.
Madam Chairman and fellow senators, good morning to you both, or to all of you, as I should say. And I appreciate the privilege of speaking to you all this morning about the small role I play with the lives of five of the clients who are currently enrolled in the Senior Companion Program. I live in Coon Rapids in Anoka County, so that's essentially where all my clients are located. Four of the clients happen to be women who range in age from 85 years to 90 years, And I also have one gentleman who is also 85 years of age. To bring these people into focus, I'd like to introduce you to June, who at 85 is very alert and aware. She does require use of a cane. As I pick her up each Monday morning, we take care of her marketing. We visit the bookstore that she prefers. We typically visit her bank. We go to a fruit stand that she likes to purchase her vegetables at. And ultimately, we share a very brief lunch. Each of these visits ends with at least two games of cribbage, at which she has become very much a challenge. Secondly, I'd like to introduce you to Helen, who is 86 years of age, whose eyesight is now so diminished that she has been advised by her doctor that she may well be totally blind before the end of this year. Lucille happens to be 90 years of age, who too requires a cane. She's a mother, a grandmother, a great-grandmother, and has now three great-great-grandchildren, including little baby Noah, now 6 months of age. She still lives alone. She looks after herself. She does her own cooking. On the other hand, she is very reliant on my coming along as scheduled because every Friday morning she has a beauty shop appointment at 9 o'clock with the same hairdresser she's had now for the last 8 years. Another lady happens to be Anona, who at 85 has survived however many spinal and neck surgeries to the point where she's absolutely housebound. Of course, I don't transport this particular woman, but we do have in-home visits of several hours. I've become very familiar with her extended family. Unfortunately, she's currently at home in a resting facility in Roseville because of a recent fall. Lastly, I'd like to introduce you to Bill, who at 85 is very much, unfortunately, suffering from Alzheimer's. Bill's thoughts no longer make any sense whatsoever. He will eat continuously in response to some unknown compelling force. He cannot be left alone when outside. He will wander. As a result, we've had to have all the door locks changed and hidden in a location that he cannot discover. I take him with me to McDonald's and wherever to provide his wife with several hours of quiet and relief. I should tell you, at 6'2", he's a real challenge for me to get him in and out of my car. But I do recognize the benefit it provides to his fans. Each and all of these wonderful people have come to rely on my being on duty as scheduled to fulfill their very basic needs, since none of them drive any longer, and whose immediate family members oftentimes are distant and or are otherwise unavailable. I have served the needs of these clients for 3+ years, and I've served others too, who unfortunately their lives have since been terminated. I'm grateful I'm able to share with you a brief look into the lives and understand the reliance of these people on myself and other volunteers throughout the state of Minnesota for the role that we play in enhancing their life, because in the final analysis, what more can they expect from people such as us in the community?
Any questions?
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you very much for your service in the volunteer program.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. I do have a question. Senator Olson, it says here, number four on one of your handouts, the COLA adjustment to recommend to help programs keep up with inflation. Who's the COLA adjustment going to? From what I understand, most of this is volunteer.
Well, Senator Rosen, there are some operating costs. They have coordinators for the volunteers, and then the volunteers get paid mileage for the transportation. In some of the programs, the volunteer might get provided a lunch.
So, Madam Chair, that would include the mileage increase that the testifiers mm-hmm. were talking
right.
about. Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I could just say briefly in closing that the money we put into supporting this program administratively really pays dividends in terms of encouraging volunteers to do exactly what we've talked about, home-based services, community services, using volunteers to allow seniors to help other seniors stay in their homes and devote their time to also helping children, our young children, to have some connection with the older generation. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to move that Senate File 485 be recommended or be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
You mean Senate File 848?
Yes, I do. I mean Senate File 848.
You've heard the motion. Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. All right. Senator Olson, do you want to take your next bill?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd now like to move to Senate File 1720, which is a bill for the Kinship Navigator Program. Madam Chair and members, today when we talk about families, we're talking about situations that are much beyond the traditional mother, dad, kids, or even so today many families and many children are living with grandparents, aunts, uncles, siblings, step-parents, or even close friends who are raising these children. Many of these, only about 15% of these non-traditional families are connected with the formal foster care system. The other 85% are served by programs like the Kinship Navigator Bill, which helps them utilize services so that they're often today finding that they're square pegs trying to fit into the round holes of the support and resource programs that are available. And Kinship Navigators really helps them to navigate this system and find the services that would be accessible to allow them to raise the children that they're responsible for in these non-traditional settings. With me today to provide information about the Kinship Navigator Bill, first is Steve Rood, who's the president of the board for the Minnesota Kinship Caregivers Association.
Both are grandparents raising grandchildren, and also Sharon Durkin, our executive director, our only staff person, is present. She was raised in a kinship home, but Lee, we lead the group through.
Chairman, Senator Berglund, and committee, my name is Dr. Lee Antel, and I'm here as a I'm here as a grandparent who is raising a granddaughter. There are many reasons for grandparents raising grandchildren. Some of them are chemical abuse, especially meth addiction, death, incarceration, young parents, single mothers without resources, and a whole host of other reasons. So we find ourselves in the position of raising our grandchildren. Nationally, some 6.7 million children are living with grandparents and other relatives raising children. And that's a 225,000 person increase in the last 5 years. 30% increase in the number of children being raised by grandparents of other relatives in the last 10 years. We estimate that 71,000 children in Minnesota live with relatives. Metro, rural, and tribal needs vary. It's important to offer resources in greater Minnesota and in the metro area to address these needs. Culturally competent programming and sensitive outreach are needed, and Senate File 1720 seeks to gain recognition, respect, and resources for kinship caregivers. On a personal note, I never expected to be a grandparent raising a granddaughter. My 20-year-old single daughter gave birth to a daughter, and shortly thereafter returned to a path of chemical addiction. And so my wife and I, both working, woke up one day with a two-week-old infant, and the mother was not present. That came as quite a shock to us, and the mother did not return home for a good 2 weeks. And so we were in a real quandary of what to do. We approached our county, which is Ramsey County, and the child was placed in foster care. And he said, well, we'd like to keep the child now that she's in foster care, but we had to become licensed foster parents before we could keep our granddaughter in our house where she had been for the previous month or previous weeks. When she was in foster care, we finally got her back, and along came foster care payments, medical assistance, and other resources. This went on for about 6 months until we gained legal custody of this granddaughter. At the moment we received legal custody, the money for foster care stopped and the medical assistance stopped, and we were on our own. Plus, we had to add insurance for her, and we had to add child care, things that we had never planned for. Not to mention being alert 24/7 now to raise an infant. Our child is now 7 years old, and what we're looking for is help and resources for other grandparents who are in the same situation as I am.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thank you for coming today.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate File 1720. My name is Sharon Olson. I'm from Elk River, Minnesota. I'm vice president of the Minnesota Kinship Caregivers Association. I'm also vice president of a national organization, Grand Families of America. More importantly, I'm a grandparent, raising grandchildren for the last 13 years. When we speak about children that are in out-of-home placement, it's often assumed that those children are in foster care. But as Lee had said, the reality is far different. Across the United States, there are less than 600,000 children that are actually in the legal custody of the state. Compare that to the fact that 6.7 million children are in the care of grandparents and other relatives without any state involvement. These grandparents and other relatives are the true safety net that prevent these children from entering the formal foster care system. Not only do we save the state an immense amount of money, but we give these children the opportunity to grow up surrounded by their family. You've often been hearing a lot lately with the children that are aging out of foster care. I can guarantee you, children do not age out of family care. We stay with these children, we sacrifice, we do whatever we need, but we do keep them within our families. Many of us have devoted our lives to not only raising the children, but also are committed to helping others that are just starting along this journey. It's a very confusing path that we travel. We don't understand the system. We don't understand what's available. We're also having to, in many times, go against our own child when we're seeking to save the children from untold things, whether it be drug abuse in the home, neglect, just various types of things that parents find themselves dealing with. So we step forward and perform a mentoring. We're there available, make ourselves available to be assisted in any way these other families that are coming forward. We found through the years that grandparents and other relatives are much more comfortable when they finally realize that they're talking to someone else that's also walked in their shoes. They're more willing to be honest, be able to talk about their true feelings, and really seek out the support that's necessary to do this. A navigator program, a Kinship Navigator Center, would actually give us an opportunity to respond to the real life issues of the grandparents and other relatives that are raising children. It's out of our life experience that changes have been made. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions?
And Madam Chair and members, just for your information, I've been, in terms of previous funding, I've been informed that there was a federal grant, a five-year grant for a pilot project to initiate this program that has expired, and the continuation of federal funding at this point is uncertain. There has been private funding that's been keeping the program going through the Bremer Foundation and some additional private funds, but without some indication that there's going to be government support for the continuation of this program, those private funds will become more difficult to obtain.
Senator Olson, you know, the legislative auditor issued a report earlier this year asking us not to name organizations to receive funding in the legislation that we pass. And I don't know how you feel about that in regard to this bill. We could take the description of this organization from their brochure and amend it into the bill and not have a named organization in the bill.
Madam Chair, I would be very amenable to making that amendment. If we could, if I could move to amend line 1.9 to delete the Minnesota Kinship Caregivers Association and to insert a program which provides service to grandparents
What we have here is, from the brochure, a nonprofit statewide organization advocating for, supporting, and providing information and resources to individuals raising their grandchildren, other related children, or children of friends.
Madam Chair, if we could incorporate that language as my amendment, I appreciate that assistance.
And then on line 11, we would delete the MKCA and insert A.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson makes that motion. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Then just one last question. If this is a two-year demonstration grant, do you want anything in the legislation that would indicate what the evaluation criteria should be for determining the success of the demonstration?
We have in the our thoughts about how this program would be implemented, we have incorporated some evaluation design with the publication of report well in advance of the completion of the two-year period.
So you don't feel it's necessary to put that into the legislation? Okay. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At this time, I would move Senate File 1720 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Any further discussion?
As amended.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Okay. Then Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I bring to you today Senate File 1320, along with one of our youngest testifiers to date, who's waited so patiently. Senate File 1320 is one of a number of bills that have made their its way through the committee that provides support to families once their baby's hearing loss has been identified. And what this bill does is it seeks to provide immediate amplification to babies with hearing loss. I will tell you very simply that I felt really compelled to carry this legislation because not that I knew an awful lot about this particular issue when I came to the state Senate, but the research is phenomenal, and the difference that early intervention can make is phenomenal. And I will just, we are going to be very brief. I want to share this letter from Michelle Schmidt. She's one of my constituents. She's an educational audiologist for the Rochester Public Schools, and she writes, I've seen firsthand the value of early amplification and intervention for children who are deaf or hard of hearing. The Hearing Aid Loaner Bank provides the bridge for newly identified babies with hearing loss throughout the state to have an early start on maximizing their residual hearing. From my experience, and I know that many of us saw that same or similar experience in Senator Marty's committee a couple of weeks ago, we have seen that early and consistent hearing aid use does provide beneficial results in speech, language, and cognitive development during the early educational intervention years. With that, I'd like to introduce my two testifiers today. I have Kirsten Coverstone and Nicole Brown, and this is Linnea. She's very happy to be with us. Kirsten.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kirsten Coverstone. I am an audiologist at the University of Minnesota and currently the coordinator of the Lions Infant Hearing Program and the statewide Loaner Bank. I first would like to thank Senator Lynch for introducing this legislation and thank Madam Chair and the members of the committee for taking the time to hear this testimony. With the advent of universal newborn hearing screening in Minnesota, the need for amplification in a timely fashion has become even more critical. There remains a gap in time between when infants and children are identified and with the medically educational significant hearing loss and the time in which they are fit with appropriate amplification. In 2001, the Hearing Instrument Loaner Bank was established to fill that time gap. This program provides a valuable service during the time that a child is first identified with the hearing loss and when payment for hearing instruments can be accomplished. It offers a family a chance to take a breath and determine all of their options without the child having to wait for access to language. Sometimes the families are in discussion with their insurance companies of whether they have coverage and if it's warranted. Other times it takes extra time to enroll the families in a program that will provide funding for hearing aids. And some families still need time just to find personal finances. The cost of these hearing aids are $3,000 to $6,000 per hearing aid. It's not inexpensive. Without the availability of this program, meaningful, critical time can be lost for the child. The funds that we are asking for pay for a position, but also pays for postage and printing and supplies. As the coordinator, it is the coordinator's job to get donations for top-of-the-line equipment for the children of Minnesota to have access to. The loaner hearing aids are loaned out to the family via the dispensing audiologist, so the coordinator works closely with the audiologist that is with the family. Some families utilize the loan for just a few months, but others utilize as much as a year if necessary. We have been able to offer flexibility. Reachers, as Senator Lynch has commented on, research shows that if a child with hearing loss has access to language before 6 months of age, they can learn speech and language along with their hearing peers. Access to language can be any combination of signing and amplification. And immediate access to these hearing aids for these families can help ensure that their child has communication options available. The Minnesota Lions have been a generous and consistent sponsor of this program. However, their initial funding has far been exceeded. Commitment to early intervention and the current statewide program has ensured that the Loaner Bank is seen as an indispensable benefit to the community. Continued coordination of the Loaner Program is needed to ensure that every infant has access to language before 6 months of age, which is critical to the outcomes of newly identified babies with hearing loss. Thank you for your consideration and support of early hearing detection and intervention. I'll have Nicole and Linnea.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Nicole Brown, and this is a picture of my four-year-old daughter, Sophia, who decided rather to be at preschool today, so she didn't come. And this is my youngest daughter, Linnea, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about the importance of the Loaner Hearing Aid Bank and what it means to children and families with hearing loss. In 2002, my daughter Sophia was diagnosed with a congenital severe hearing loss at about 6 weeks of age. As you can imagine, for a first-time parent with no experience with hearing loss, this was initially a devastating diagnosis for us. Our dreams and our expectations for our healthy baby girl were crushed when we anticipated what the future might look like for her. One horrifying statistic for a child with hearing loss similar to hers played over and over and over in our heads. At the average reading level of a child with a hearing loss is a third grade reading level at their high school graduation. We asked ourselves how she would communicate with our friends and our family. When Sophia was 2 months old, we began early intervention services through our school district. She received her first pair of loaner hearing aids when she was 4 months old, and she loved them. She never wanted to take them out. She loves hearing all the sounds around her. However, it took a few trials with a few different kinds of hearing aids before our audiologist was satisfied with which hearing aid was best for her and for her hearing loss. Then, at 9 months, we purchased her first pair of hearing aids, so about almost 5 months later, and which she wore every day until recently when she received her cochlear implant. Sophia is a true testament to the benefits of early intervention. Next fall, she'll be starting kindergarten at her neighborhood school with her hearing or with her peers and her friends. And on standardized assessment tests, she scores above average in speech and language compared to her hearing peers. I'm a proud mom. I can now again once embrace all the dreams and expectations I had for Sophia the day she was born. Last August, our third daughter, Linnea, was born, and we waited anxiously at the hospital for the results of the newborn hearing screen. And she didn't pass, unfortunately. At 10 days of age, we learned of our hearing loss. She has a profound hearing loss, and she's deaf. Less than 1 week later, we were able to receive her first pair of hearing aids from the Loaner Hearing Aid Bank. These hearing aids, the one she's wearing right now, are provided on an interim basis until she receives her cochlear implant, which is scheduled for next month. We're so appreciative that we don't need to spend the $6,000 to buy hearing aids that she'll just be using for 6 months. To ensure that every newborn baby has an equal chance and the same opportunities as Sophia and Linnea to reach their full potential, all babies should receive their newborn hearing screening for further diagnosis and intervention if needed. And in order to assure the earliest access to sound for all infants and children with a hearing loss, they should have access to a loaner hearing aids and a loaner hearing aid bank. Thank you.
Members, I'm pleased to remind you that the governor has provided in his budget some additional funds for in the areas of deaf and hard of hearing. And it's my hope that the committee will be able to work within that to include this as part of that appropriation as well.
The governor's appropriation, I believe, is through the Department of Human Services. This is through the Department of Health, so it would be a request above the governor's request. We think we need a little clarification in the language, Senator Lynch, because it isn't really clear that this is a grant. I believe you want it to be a grant to the instrument loan bank. And the language isn't clear as to whether the department is to administer this or whether it's to be another organization. I believe you want it to be another organization.
I would take that as a friendly suggestion and amendment. And if council wants to can come up with something like that, that'd be great.
Madam Chair, I think on line 7, after providing, if we insert a grant to cover administrative costs for a statewide hearing aid and instrument loan bank to families with children and the rest of it, and then on line 9, and 10, take out that section. This appropriation shall cover the administrative costs of the program. Delete that.
Senator Lynch would move that amendment. Those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. And then maybe you can just tell us with the $140,000 how many more families you anticipate you would be able to serve, and do you believe you'll be able to get donations of hearing equipment for that those families?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Yes, and to date, that's part of the job that I currently do. And to date, as an audiologist, I have a working relationship with many of the manufacturers and convince them to donate top-of-the-line technology. And as you know, that changes each year. So I currently have over $400,000+ worth of equipment donated to the program and see no changes in that at this point. Each year we've been able to increase the number of hearing instruments in the bank because each year the number of families has increased.
Does that answer your question? Who is paying for your salary now?
Right now, the Lions of Minnesota.
And are you anticipating that that funding will not be there?
It has already been. The initial grant from the Lions was a five-year grant, which started in 99 for a different program. This was added into that because of the need was so evident. And it has for 2 years, we've begged for continuation, and they've been able to scrape this and that together, but it's just not there anymore. They have committed to other grants and programs.
And this $140,000, is that what they have been contributing to you up till now?
Actually, more.
I see. And so do you anticipate serving the same number of families then that you've served in the past?
Yes, Madam Chair and committees, I'm actually getting better at getting donations. And so the equipment is actually there. Does that answer the
question? And would this fund one staff position for 2 years? Is that the idea?
It would cover this, Madam Chair and committee. It would cover the staff position. It would cover printing. It would cover postage. Postage is how we send the hearing instruments back and forth. It would cover the printing of a survey. We send a survey out to the families after the loan is over to evaluate the program. On the back of some of your materials are comments from families from that survey. But it covers additional costs than just the position.
Okay, any other questions? Guess there are none. Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 1320 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion.
In the omnibus bill. Any further discussion of that motion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, members, thank you very much.
I do believe that completes our agenda for today. Thank you, members, for staying a little extra.
Thank you. Thank you very much.